IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. What happens when I say the word Tibet? Do you imagine the Dalai Lama? Do you imagine a motorbike with Tibetan flags fluttering over it? Do you imagine these dramatic photos of sunset on the Potala Palace? What if I were to tell you that the history of Tibet is actually immeasurably more complex than we might think from the way that Tibet is generally represented in modern media? Tibet has a history that involves pretty remarkable individuals, pretty brutal military campaigns, a religious persecution, extraordinary religious proliferation and evolution. And broadly speaking, until the early modern period, Tibet was one of the great geopolitical centers of Asia more broadly. It controlled vast swathes of Central Asia. It competed with the Chinese, with the Turks, with the Arabs. And it also, over various periods, extended considerable influence into the Gangetic Plains as well. The history of Tibet is far, far, far more than the stereotypes that we usually have. What we're going to be doing over the next 30 to 40 minutes is we're going to be unpacking the history of this remarkable geopolitical region. We're going to be trying to understand the major themes of Tibetan history, the major periods in Tibetan history, try to figure out what really went down in this area. And perhaps over the course of another episode or so, we'll actually talk more broadly about how these themes continue to impact the way that Tibet and the Tibetan diaspora see themselves and their place in the world today. And without any further ado, though, let me welcome my guest for today, Shivam Bahuguna. Hi, Shivam. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Nirodh. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a pleasure to have you here, Shivam. So to all of our listeners, Shivam is a PhD scholar in international relations at South Asia University, and he's working on a very interesting thesis on Buddhism in foreign policy, which unfortunately we can't discuss right now. Shivam is going to be talking to us about the themes that I just brought up, about the way that Tibet is perceived, and more generally, how to understand Tibetan history. So Shivam, let's begin. Can you tell us a little bit about how you think about the way that Tibet is generally perceived in the public consciousness today?
So I think it was the sociologist Diane Watson that had talked about that there's this particular archetype of the Oriental monk that exists in the Western culture. And indirectly, we Anglophone Indians also sort of ended up receiving it.
Right.
So there's this image of the Oriental monk, which sort of has this some deep wisdom which the Western quote-unquote rational mind cannot comprehend. And this sort of image got applied to a lot of people. I mean, it's not just the Dalai Lama. So like D.T. Suzuki, another Zen Buddhist monk who was the first to introduce Buddhism to the West. So he also, you know, was perceived through this image. Then there are these pop culture characters like the Jedi Master Yoda, or you know, one of the gurus in a TV series called Karate. So these had also, you know, been seen through this Oriental lens. And then, of course, there's this image of the Shangri-La, the perfect utopia, where everyone is at peace and things are all going great. And right. I think if you also watch the movie 7 Years in Tibet, so there's this line where one of the characters, the Peter Aufschneider, who's also a real person, by the way. So he too had remarked in a particular scene when the Chinese plane descends from the skies to a makeshift runway. And he said, you know, there's trouble in paradise. So, I mean, that also struck me is that, you know, like within a lot of people, I think, so this particular image of Tibet as a very exotic place, I mean, it's beautiful geographically, but yeah, I mean, so there's this sense of mysticism that we attach to Tibet. So we have to sort of, you know, go past it. As nice as it, or as interesting as this image makes it seem, but I think when we actually go into details, so we come across things that populate any other any other region's history, right?
Right.
We come across wars, we come across petty politics, we come across, you know, all the drama that happens in any place in history. So that sort of makes it fun, right? So that the more you read, the more you see Tibet as a real place,
right?
With human beings, with fallible human beings, that makes it a much better, much more satisfying read.
Absolutely, those are very interesting points, and like it's pretty amazing to think about just how pervasive the stereotype is, right? If you look at, for example, Doctor Strange, the entire thing literally reads as almost this fantasy of this rational white person who learns this profound Oriental wisdom and becomes so good at it that even the Orientals are surprised and decide to learn from him. It's a pervasive stereotype. In fact, one of my favorite games, Uncharted 2, features Shangri-La or Shambhala in a very, very major role, though it's somewhat interesting because it's a little darker than it's generally portrayed as in Western media. But still, the fundamental stereotype kind of remains. You know, there's these monasteries and there's these laughing monks and who are super chill and who don't have any human emotions aside from being totally at peace with one another all the time. But as you said, actually understanding these flesh and blood people gives us a deeper insight into why any part of the world is the way it is. And the thing is that even though media gives us this simplified kind of stereotype of like every region, like, okay, yeah, you know, India is this overcrowded place where everybody likes cows, or China is this super efficient place where it's super polluted, or the West is this bastion of freedom, and ancient Greece was the most democratic place that ever existed. Despite all of that, once you like actually dig deeper into the actual events and the human beings behind them, you start to see that the reality of history is so much more complex and so much more intuitive for us to understand, because it is, we see the flaws that we recognize in ourselves in historical figures as well, which of course brings me to actually trying to understand the history of Tibet. Now, Tibet really like explodes onto the historical scene in the 7th century with the emergence of the Tibetan Empire, Sungtsen Gampo. Now, Sungtsen Gampo like really exemplifies a lot of what we were talking about earlier, right? Because though, of course, the sources from the period are a little bit fragmentary and so on, he emerges as this remarkably, how do I put this, pragmatic and more than a little kind of pretentious kind of individual who is also a fairly ambitious and capable military leader who really expands Tibetan power to the point where it's really a great power on par with that of the Turks or the Arabs or even the Chinese. So can you tell us a little bit more about this Tibetan Empire? What was its extent? Where the hell was it? What was it interested in doing? And who were the people who were leading it?
All right. So before we, you know, get into the how Sungtsen Gampo came into power, so I'll give a very small introduction on how this lineage came into being.
Sure.
And as expected, a lot of Tibetan sources, by the way, so they sort of go in retrospect, right? So they trace into, you know, undocumented history, or like pretty much similar to how in India a lot of lineages, you know, get traced to a certain deity,
yeah,
or to a certain mythical being. So you find this also in Tibetan history. So like Shakapa himself, you know, he traces this like legend, I would say. So according to legend, how this particular lineage came into being. So there was a particular family in Bodh Gaya, Bihar.
Hmm.
And that child was born with a full set of teeth, with webbed fingers and with certain features which sort of made him very strange to look at.
The great signs of the great man in Buddhist mythology.
Yes, yes, yes. Hmm. So he was earlier, father hid him out of shame.
Hmm.
And later when he grew up, he ended up wandering and he went to Tibet, right? And in Tibet, when he reached, it was a particular place called Yaluk.
Hmm.
And so at Yaluk, the native Tibetans asked him, where did he come from? And due to a certain miscommunication, because he didn't know the language, he pointed us towards the sky.
Huh.
So at that time, the people were, you know, of what is now called the Bon Faith. I'll also deconstruct that term a bit later.
Sure.
So they took it as a good sign, because in the Bon belief, sky is sacred, right?
Huh.
It's sort of pretty similar to Mongols, I would say, that they too attach a certain sacredness to the sky. So they made him king. And then later, he was the first, like, according to legend, he was the first to build a house And earlier, the Tibetans lived in cave. So mind you, here is the fact that a lot of these legends come from Buddhist sources. So they have at least throughout, at least pre-modern Buddhist sources are, you know, sort of a bit disparaging of the born folks as simplistic or as cave dwellers, etc. So this is not as... I'm yet to read a source which is outrightly critical of the bone fox, but I think you run across these themes when you look at Tibet, and that sort of also brings me to a mind to a certain kind of like how we have a certain Western bias, that how we have a we talk about a Chinese bias or an Indian bias. So I think reading this, you know, you sort of also become aware that there is something called a Tibetan bias. It's because they, like any other people, any other flesh and blood, quote unquote, people would have biases of their own.
Of course.
And I think one of the, when you read into these Tibetan primary sources, or specifically because I'm reading it through the historian, so you come across this bias as well. And it's nice because it sort of humanizes the place and it shows that they too, you know, have a history of their own. So anyway, so this particular king, started out the Senpo lineage. So the name comes from what Shakapa says, the eighth king. So the belief, again, this is this sort of, you know, we are right now in the place where myth and history are sort of still intertwined according to the people who recount them. So it's believed that they had a certain sky rope attached to them, like sort of, imagine like a sort of a divine, you know, a rope of light, and when they would die, they would ascend to heaven. And the eighth king is said to have accidentally cut off the rope, and his name was Trigum Senpo. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. So he got buried in what is called the first tomb of kings at Kongpo in Utsang. Utsang is one of the central regions of Tibet. So there are broadly three regions of Tibet. I think although there are some contesting or some more in terms of those who have studied Tibetan geography would of course have a much nuanced viewpoint, but for a broader understanding, there are three regions. So the Utsang is the, you know, the central, the quote unquote heartland, what Mackinder uses. Then of course there is Kham, which is towards the east. And then there is Amdo, which is towards the northeast. And if you have ever been to any Tibetan refugee colony, etc., you will find a lot of these establishments named them after Kham or Amdo. Like when I went to Majnuka Tila, so Kham and Amdo were name of different restaurants. So you find these references littered across India, specifically if you go let's say Uttarakhand or Himachal Pradesh. Anyway, so this aside, so from there, you know, begins the lineage of the Senpos, and of course the most important of at least the first important Senpo that comes is the gentleman that you mentioned, the King Songtsen Gampo. So he is, you know, the first of the three Dharma kings of Tibet. So Dharma kings of Tibet, as you would know, is one of the important classification which they give to three monarchs, which are very important. And two of them, you know, feature much more prominently in the geopolitics that happened. So the Songtsen Gampo was the first, and Trisong Detsen, another gentleman, another very interesting person, was the second. So Songtsen Gampo, as you mentioned, so he was, you know, a very pragmatic politician. He was a pretty good general, and he expanded his kingdom's reach, and under him, essentially all, you know, Tibetan chieftains and all gradually came under his rule. And, you know, from that emerged the Tibetan Empire. So what we see as Tibetan, the autonomous province that we have, is only a part of what was there. So if you look at different sources for how much the Tibetan Empire spanned, you will come across, you know, a variety of maps. And I think so the basic area that was covered was was this, you know, the Utsang, the central heartland, Kham, which is the east, and Amdo, which is towards the northeast. And of course, in the later stages, when the Tibetan Empire would also, you know, wrestle with Tang Dynasty in China. And as you would know, that they also did manage to give them a bloody nose at a bunch of times. So in this case, I go into a certain episode. And I think, so one of the, if you like episodes, I think the one book that you should read is Sam Banshaik's. So all the other books are, I think, more detailed from a historian's point of view. But from a, but for someone who is looking to begin their, you know, exploration of Tibet, I think Banshaik and Shakapa are two really good ways of. So I think, so he also begins with this episode. And I think this episode hooked me into Tibetan history, and I'm sort of hoping that it also hooks everyone else. Banshaik begins with a particular winter in the year 763.
Okay.
So it was the city of Chang'an, the capital of the Tang Empire.
Huh.
So what happened is that Tibetan army, you know, invaded and reached the capital of Chang'an. And so as you know, any historic assaults go, so they had, you know, sort of overrun the capital. And Banshaik points out is that it, like he said, you know, it was no simple barbarian onslaught. Of course, the barbarian terms, you know, features a lot in Chinese history, right, as you would know, is that anyone too far away from them would be barbarian. People similar to them would get a sort of a status of, like, somewhat you are, you know, recognized as a tributary. So anyway, yes. So the Tibetans had, you know, sort of used, you know, military tactics in terms of, like, they had, you know, lured out the general and his army to fight them somewhere else, and then sent a division to the capital, and with the capital was undefended. So the capital city got ransacked, and the palace was sort of, you know, completely intimidated and then overrun. And then they installed some other king, and then they left for a while. And of course, later the Tang Dynasty was able to restore. But I think what stayed with the Chinese is that, you know, they had never thought that the Tibetans would become, you know, this strong. Because throughout, if you look at how the Chinese had always viewed Tibetans, so specifically the earlier Chinese would have had sort of, you know, looked at early Tibetans as, you know, some types of barbarians. So they too were, you know, in a massive shock when something like this happened. And you would also see that Songtsen Gampo had, you know, undertaken these, you know, military campaigns, and he would often be, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the Tang military. So that's one of the, and I think, and this was, you know, kept up by Trisong Detsen, who came up a bit later. So this was Songtsen Gampo. I mean, that's one of his crowning instances or crowning episode was that he was able to march into the Chinese capital. And of course, given that he is one of the Dharma kings of Tibet, so one of the interesting insights that happened during Songtsen Gampo is how that Tibet, that Buddhism finally, you know, started to get introduced to Tibet. And this happened, interestingly, through wives. So it's just a matter of coincidence that So the two, of course, you know, as any king, they would have, you know, multiple wives, they would have consorts, they would have mistresses, and these terms sort of merge into each other. So he had one Nepali wife called Princess Bhrikuti. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right. So Princess Bhrikuti was a Buddhist, and she was influential in getting the Jokhang Temple, you know, one of the oldest Buddhist temples in Tibet. So she was influential in getting Jokhang built. And it's another interesting thing is that he had another Chinese wife, called Princess Wenqing.
Yeah.
Which, this is again, these names I have taken from Shakapa's account. And of course, there might be a few, you know, variations in spellings or in pronunciations. So, and it just so happened that she was also Buddhist. So the first, you know, the first set of temples or first set of Buddhist institutions were built during Song Sen Gampo's time. And this was, So the Buddhist temple that was built by Princess Bhrikuti faced Nepal. And the temple built by his Chinese wife, Princess Wenqing, faced China. And there's also an instance where they exchanged their idols because at one point the Chinese had been invading. So this is a postscript attached to this particular information is that they had exchanged it when they were worried that what if the Chinese folks, you know, ransack the temple? So they were hoping that, you know, that they won't touch the Chinese temple, so the Nepali Buddhist statue would stay safe there. I'm sort of blurring on these details because I had read this before my submission. So another important thing that happened during the reign of Song Sen Gampo is that the move towards a sort of a centralized or certain forms of centralization. So Song Sen Gampo sort of did a very startup thing. he got ink and paper from China and he sent people to India to develop a writing system because he wanted to, you know, sort of make his administration a bit more formal. So Song Sen Gampo is again important because he moved Tibet to the path that I think when we talk about how states develop in ancient and medieval history, you talk about, you know, the establishment of a formal court language, you talk about certain patronage, religious patronage. So Song Sen Gampo for Tibet, you know, began these important processes. This is again a legend that's Shakapa talks about us. So according to the legend, he sent a young man from a Tonmi clan, which is perhaps one of the elite clans in Tibet. So he sent a young man and who, after a very difficult toil in India, he finally found a learned man, you know, a Brahmin. And he had asked him that, can you teach me a writing system? And the man had replied, I know all writing systems. What do you want to know? So at that time, it is said that he learned all of India's, you know, writing systems that were prevalent. And using those, the Tibetan alphabet was discovered. So if you look at the Tibetan alphabet, you will see very, you know, clear similarities with the Indian one. They also have at least the North Indian one, I would say. They have these, you know, the lines on the top and the concept of the matra and all. Correct. You will find these in the Tibetan script as well. So Song Sen Gampo specifically sent teams to India. And I think this, you know, sort of began a cultural entwinement with India, which would, you know, carry on even after he had died. And so this is a part of Indian or even Tibetan history. This part sort of gets ignored because when we are growing up, we don't read much about Tibet in Indian history books. But I think we would certainly do well to actually read about it.
Absolutely.
So this process is again one of the interesting things. And so as far as Song Sen Gampo's military exploits are concerned, of course, there began the process of, you know, of the developing of the Tibetan script, of the slow trickle of Buddhism into the royal court. So the interesting point here is that the process was slow and it took quite a lot of time to actually go down to the common folks. It took a while. And one of the interesting episodes, again, another episode that sort of, you know, talks about how well Songtsen Gampo was in terms of military. So there was a certain city called Khotan. And it was, it's towards, I think it's historically much nearer to Shanyang, to the place where, you know, the Turkic and the Sinic populations start to sort of merge. So anyway, Khotan was a Buddhist city, at least till the 15th century. They gradually got Islamized under the Turks. So in the 670s, Khotan was a thriving Buddhist city. And during that time, so there was a particular book called The Inquiry of Vimala Prabha, which talks about how Khotan was suffering in the 670s because a certain people would keep invading it. So the irony here is that the villains against Buddhism at that time were the Tibetans.
Hmm.
So in the 670s, all the way to Khotan, it were the Tibetans who were actually, you know, wreaking havoc across Central Asia. And again, after Songtsen Gampo ended his reign, so a while later, the second Thama king who ascended was Trisong Detsen in 757. And Trisong Detsen was really, you know, really quite a whirlwind of a personality, because it's not just simply that he had great military conquests or he was a great administrator, but the strides that were made under, like, for institutionalization of Buddhism is also, you know, also pretty important. And these, I think, we'll talk about in the next chapter when we talk about how Buddhism, Tibet got, became Buddhist.
That's absolutely fascinating. But before we actually get deeper into the reign of this remarkable individual, Shivam, let's actually go to a quick ad break, and then we can go over the themes of Songtsen Gampo's rule once again, and then move to a deeper discussion about Buddhist Tibet.
Absolutely.
Hey, welcome back. We've been talking about the fascinating reign of this individual called Songtsen Gampo, the first Tibetan emperor. And a lot of very, very interesting themes were brought up. What I find most fascinating is that Songtsen is clearly this warlord who has risen to power over what was primarily a tribal and pastoral society. He has managed to unite all these different clans under his reign through extraordinary displays of military success. And what he does now that he is the undisputed leader and has this undisputed power base and popularity is that he tries to institutionalize his power and make it something that can be transmitted down to his descendants. And he does this by taking in innovations from the world as he knows it. And in order to do that, he specifically looks to India and China, these two great kind of cultural juggernauts with enormous populations that have been evolving for many, many centuries. And he tries to use them to create this very unique kind of facade of Tibetan power, which I find very interesting. Shivam mentioned, for example, the fact that he was going out of his way to cultivate marriage alliances with the Chinese and the Nepalese, and that his wives are attested as being Buddhist. I find that very interesting, right? Because if we look at parallels to the rest of Central Asian history, if you were to look particularly at other conquerors who have united pastoral nomadic peoples, such as, say, Chinggis Khan or Timur the Lame, they do very, very similar things in terms of solidifying their power through marriage to more legitimate power centers. Timur, for example, marries a descendant of Chinggis Khan, and Timur and Chinggis Khan both are known as extremely capable generals and as cultural innovators. They take these ideas that are in circulation from the world as they know it, and they use it to create cultural capital, essentially. And we can see Songtsen Gampo doing the exact same thing. Here he is marrying women from across the world, or across his world, as he would have put it. And he is bringing with them Buddhism. And he's not doing this, I mean, it's difficult to, of course, know his exact motivations, but it seems like this is something that he was doing as a political calculation as much as out of genuine religious conviction. Because being associated with these very prestigious foreign religions is something that is attested to generally increase the prestige of a native dynasty. We see this happening in Cambodia and in Indonesia as well. We were intermarrying with Indians, for example, and showing that there is some kind of connection to this prestigious foreign religion is very, very important to dynasty, to various dynasties, especially those of, say, Funan and Champa. So it's so fascinating to see these parallels kind of emerging in Tibetan history. And as we said in the beginning of this podcast, once you actually understand the reality of what went down, and once you actually once you see these events and try to fit these events within the broader patterns of what we know happened in other regions, you start to see a much more intuitive and very quote-unquote real picture of this history actually emerging, which I find extremely exciting. So thank you for that, Shivam. And why don't you tell us a little more about the crowning jewel of Buddhist Tibet, which you mentioned just before we went to our ad break.
All right. Okay, before I talk about the second Dharma king, that is Trisong Detsen, another of Songtsen Gyampo's conquests had slipped my mind, and it's just so unfair to him that I forgot to mention the one of his biggest conquests. So one of it was the city in the the surrounding area of this of Zhangzhou. It used to be one of the the Tang dynasty. It used to be Tang dynasty area of influence. So Zhangzhou is also important in Tibetan history, is because the Bon religion's ultimate stronghold was Zhangzhou. And so how Zhangzhou actually happened was through very classic marriage and cloak and daggers sort of thing, is that the Tibetan princess went to Zhangzhou as a bride, and there she started to work as a spy, and she would send all information that she gathered back to Lhasa. And when later the war actually took place, the Songtsen Gyampo was already at an advantage because half the Zhangzhou court was compromised thanks to her. So, and at that time it was during this time that the Tibetan Empire was also interfered in the politics of Nepal. So the King Narendra Dev, when he was ousted from Nepal, he had fled to Lhasa. And when he had returned in the 630s. And when he returned to Nepal in 640s. So it was a mix of his own troops and the Tibetan army. So this is again an instance of the extent to which Tibet was able to exercise influence, is that they could install a preferred king at the throne of Nepal, and they were able to steal steal a Tang city through classic spy games.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I find it interesting because there's also these very obvious parallels to Indian history as well, which aren't generally very well known. So, I mean, the example you gave of a princess essentially causing the collapse of the dynasty that she married into just brings to mind the dynasty of Harshavardhana of Kanauj. How Harsha managed to get control of Kanauj is, of course, the story is extensively retold by his court poet Banabhatta. But similarly, his sister Rajashri marries into what is ostensibly the most powerful dynasty in the Gangetic Plains at the time. And then very suddenly, her husband dies, and all of a sudden, her brothers are in charge of the empire. It's very interesting to see, to the point where the fact that Harsha's dynasty came from Thaneshwara or Thanesar, not from Kanauj, is generally kind of forgotten. And another example of the same thing happening, where an ambitious king is apparently marrying his daughter into this rival dynasty and then invading at the appropriate moment to kind of seize territory or install a different candidate, happens in Odisha in I think the 10th century, where you have this princess called Prithivi Mahadevi, a princess of the Somavamshi dynasty of Dakshina Kosala, which is in modern Chhattisgarh, who are rivals of the Bhamakaras who rule on the Odia coast. And she marries into the Bhamakara dynasty, and then very conveniently her brother invades after her husband's death when there's no candidates for succession. And she essentially becomes the ruler of Odisha for quite a period of time because of that. So again, this kind of absolutely ruthlessly pragmatic politics is so integral to the way that power was kind of enforced in the medieval period. And so interesting to see the same thing happening in Tibet as well. But before we get too lost in the machinations of power and ruthlessness, let's talk a little bit about religion. Tell us about the crowning moment of Tibetan Buddhism.
So I think both in terms of its political power and in terms of its institutionalization of Buddhism, both happened under Trisong Detsen. I think he's a very fascinating historical character. I wish we could have a full length, full budget biopic on him. I would definitely be, you know, first day, first show. So anyway, so Trisang Detson's, you know, he ascended somewhere in the 750s. So he's called the second Dharma King. And also just a small correction in the earlier part that Songtsen Gampo was in a line of you know, kings, but he was the first to sort of unify it in a way. So, I mean, yeah, in a that way, he would be the first emperor. Anyway, sorry, this was needless. So the second Dharma King, again, came a while after Songtsen Gampo. So Trisong Detson's rise came in a very interesting time. So at the time, China had descended into chaos. And there was a particular general called An Lushan who had launched a coup against the Tang dynasty. And Tang loyalists had eventually gotten rid of him by 700, somewhere in the early 760s. But they had taken the help of the Uyghurs, and that had weakened them in the process. So it was during this time that, you know, Trisong Detson risen. And under him, when he was, you know, like his predecessor Songtsen Gampo, he was also pragmatic. He could also see that there are, you know, that the Tang dynasty is weak and that he has room to spread. And that's what he actually did. So his army was also, you know, able to reach pretty close to Chang'an, and which Chang'an by that time was, you know, a much, much weaker city than before. And what the interesting thing about the Trisong imperial reach is that he was able to control quite a bunch of cities in Western China, which were part of the Silk Route trade. So under Trisong Detson, another important thing happened, which sort of did help in the spread of Buddhism, is that the Tibetans now also had at least some form of power in terms of how the Silk Route trade would go. And they too, you know, got a fair share of the trade. And this wealth was ultimately helpful in the spread of Buddhism, because Trisong Detson spent quite a lot of the state treasury on institutionalizing Buddhism to an extent that, like, not even Songtsen Gampo had done.
That's a very interesting and very important bunch of points that you brought up. The first is the fact that it's a very kind of multi-ethnic time, right? Generally, when we think about any region's history, given that we live in a very nationalist world, the tendency is to think about history as only done by one single ethnic group or one single religion. Whereas if you were to look at a Tang to China, you see that there's actually many, many peoples involved in shaping its history the way it's gone. It's not just about the Han Chinese. An Lushan was actually a Sogdian. Sogdians originally come from the region corresponding to modern Tajikistan. And of course, you've gone over like how the Tibetans were also involved in their history. And you mentioned the Uyghurs as well. So we have to keep in mind, right, when all these events are being talked about, that there are many, many ethnicities, many, many peoples who are constantly in circulation. And the way that trade is happening also is through the system of like relays, right? Where you have people who are moving from point to point. So, you know, trade could have taken from point A to point B by one group of people, from point B to point C by another group of people, and so on and so forth. So what is really happening in this period then is that the relays of the Silk Road, which previously went mostly a little north of Tibet, are now also being extended into Tibet itself proper. So there's a new kinds of markets that are being explored. There's new kinds of connections between like buyers and sellers and producers and markets that are being created. So there's simultaneously economic growth, and it's being kind of funneled into Buddhism in order to kind of create this closer and closer tie between political and economic and cultural power, which is centered around the Tibetan emperors.
Yes. So I think in this process, what happened to the city of Dunhuang is a very interesting case. So Dunhuang was, again, one of the cities in the western region of the Tang Empire. So Dunhuang had held out against the Tibetans for quite a long time. Like they survived a siege for 11 years. And then gradually they sort of succumbed. And what happened there after that is that the city was culturally Tibetanized, as in the most of the folks there were, you know, were the Han Chinese, but they were, you know, forced to learn the Tibetan language, forced to wear clothes like Tibetans. The top administration was taken over by Tibetans. The official calendar was the Tibetan calendar. The way the land and taxes happened were Tibetan. And of course, there was there were these, you know, Tibetan populations who would settle there, you know, in bits. So that sort of created a certain form of hybrid culture, which interestingly helped later when the Tibetan Empire collapsed. So those places which became these, you know, these centers of hybrid culture, they sort of then acted as a repositories. So this is what I think what the entire Tibetan history would make a podcast of its own, I would say.
But really? Yeah, I mean, that's such an interesting dynamic, because
yes,
we know that like this kind of insisting on a particular kind of costume, a particular kind of culture, something that the Chinese did when they're expanding into Vietnam, for example.
Yeah.
So clearly the Tibetans have learned from the lessons of other empires, and
yes,
they're trying to incorporate them into their own kind of imperial systems.
Yes.
That's so fascinating.
Yes, because if you recount this in 21st century, right? So specifically, if you recount this to someone who has not read Tibetan history, that person would be, you know, shocked that he or she would say, you know, okay, I hear this kind of things about what China is doing to the Tibetans.
Yeah.
So you would never think that there was a particular time when even the Tibetans were able to do this to the Chinese. So it sort of, you know, puts how, you know, the flows and ebbs of history. So yes.
Okay. Wow. This is so fascinating. I have so many thoughts, but we're already nearing the end of our time today. So to all our listeners, I know that we started off promising that we're going to talk about Buddhism in Tibetan as well. And I promise that we will do that in a future episode, because you will not believe how incredible and complex and really, really messed up the history of Tibetan Buddhism is. So Shivam, thank you so much for joining us. We will have you back on All Things Policy again very soon to talk more about Tibetan Buddhism and the way that it impacts its history. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And thank you all for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.